Thanks everyone for being here today. So my name is Ignacio Ferias. I'm a professor of modern anthropology at the Institute for European Ethnology. I'm a member here of the EDSS thesis. I'm also a member of the Georg Simmel Centrum for Metropolitan Studies at the HU. And my background is in, let's say, sociology, anthropology, and STS, in that sort of biographical order. I did my PhD at the Humboldt University in the Department of European Ethnology in 2008 with a dissertation about knowledge practices and infrastructures of urban tourism in Berlin, basically looking at how tourism knows a city like Berlin, what kind of knowledge practices and technologies go into that. And since then, basically, I've been interested in studying cities, not as a sort of a context out there, but as something that is constructed or better assembled by means of specific practices. So basically, the city as an epistemic and also affective object that is practically and socio-materially assembled in different ways. The inspiration for this approach was, I guess, my first set of encounters with science and technology studies, and particularly with actor network theory. And much of my sort of theoretical or work has been about trying to mobilize and trying to adapt some of these theoretical insights and concepts from ANT and STS to think or rethink the urban. As a postdoc researcher at the Wissenschaftszentrum Berlin für Sozialforschung in the backland of the Kulturforum at Potsdamer Platz, I pursued this interest in how cities are constructed or rather reconstructed in specific sites, basically in two directions, right? The first one was a set of small studies about how architects and designers mostly reconstruct the city in their studios, in their offices, kind of basically sort of replicating a long tradition in STS of laboratory studies, but trying to take this to understand the specificity of studio practice and design practices by means of these studio ethnographies. That was one of the avenues. And the second avenue came by surprise in the form of a tsunami, if you want. I mean, literally, and it involved studying the urban reconstruction process in Chile that followed the tsunami and the earthquake from 2010, and which heavily destroyed and damaged coastal cities. And perhaps this is the moment in my sort of academic career, somewhere around 2010, where I started to engage more systematically in issues which I see more directly connected to the research agenda of the IRE thesis. As I started to look and study more explicitly socio-natural disasters in cities and the redesign of cities for adapting to kind of future and also present environmental threats, right? After that, I then moved to Munich, to the Technical University in Munich, where I had one of the first professorships, assistant professorships at the Munich Center for Technology and Society, which is nowadays the largest STS center, and I think it is the first now STS department in Germany. And I spent three years there, working there as an assistant professor. And in that time, I basically PI'd, if that's a verb, I PI'd two research projects involving kind of very strong, let's say, interdisciplinary and transdisciplinary collaborations. The more transdisciplinary one was in collaboration with the Urban Planning Department of the City of Munich and many other actors, companies, blah, blah, from the urban development sort of area. And it basically, on my part in that larger consortium, entailed experimenting with formats for participatory design of so-called smart infrastructures. And even though, let's say, our task was to engage the public, kind of to invoke the public and bring the public into these settings to participate of the design of these infrastructures, it soon became evident for all of us that our real task, and in a way, our secret agenda, was rather engaging the experts, kind of actually luring experts into these spaces of collaborations, I mean, into spaces of collaborations where their expertise could be truly challenged. And that was by far the most tough part of that project, not engaging the public. The more interdisciplinary project in Munich was a collaboration with landscape architects and environmental engineers in a project that was basically dealing with the challenges that the urban heat island effect, the urban heat poses to the future, let's say, of urban squares. A project that involved, learning to think like an architect in a way, or like a landscape architect, but had also a very strong policy side, I have to say, as it involved kind of developing recommendations for the Bavarian Ministry of the Environment and Consumer Affairs, I think it's called, on how to reimagine public squares, urban squares, as experimental sites for prototyping and also problematizing human environment relationships. So in sum, as my research interests concern, all these kind of current transformations of urban infrastructures and urban ecologies, and which I look from different perspectives. So on the one hand, I'm very much interested in developing what I call an anthropology of urbanism, that deals, precisely with these processes of redesign and reconstructing urban environments, urban assemblages, and understanding that urbanism is a sort of recursive process of reckoning with the unintended effects and the collateral costs of urbanistic transformation. So it's a recursive, I understand urbanism as a recursive process dealing all the time with its own consequences. So that's one part of it. The other part of it is also paying attention to all these environmental disruptors, let's say, the material and non-human overflows that are constantly putting these human designs to test, right? And related to that, what interests me as well is the question of how to think about, participation and the articulation of different types of knowledge, different types of modes of experiencing and valuing the city, different value regimes, how to bring all that into this urban planning and urban design processes, the question of how to give voice, how to articulate different epistemic and affective positions vis-a-vis the urban, which in my understanding is perhaps one of the most dramatic and the most crucial political questions when it comes to reimagining cities in the Anthropocene. Precisely, I mean, this politics of knowledge is, of course, crucial. This is not news for you. It's basically to make sure that to state that we're on the same page, perhaps, on this point. So this is me, basically. I came to the Humboldt in 2018. I became, as Axel said, I became back then already a member of IDCCS. But I haven't really managed to be an active member of it yet. And I hope that this will now change in the future. So what I would like to do today with the rest of my time is basically two things. One is to tell you about two upcoming research projects, which are very important to me and that will take up most of my time and effort during the next 4 or 5 years. So this is exactly what I'm going to be doing in the next 4 or 5 years. And that's kind of research project rhetorics in a way. And secondly, I would also like to share some empirical insights and empirical reflections, particularly about the regulation of environmental noise in Europe, which was one of the things that inspired, let's say, these two projects that I'm going to tell you about. Okay, so how am I doing with time? I mean, I think I have like 45 minutes for the whole thing, right, Axel? Okay, brilliant. So maybe you let me know when it's like a bit before that so that I can, yeah, so basically in the two projects that I would like to introduce now, and hopefully in other projects to come, I will be studying, let's say, airborne environmental phenomena that pose different types of challenges to urban life as we know it. And more specifically, I will be looking at different sets of practices and technologies for knowing and governing these airborne environmental disruptors or stressors. So one of such phenomena is urban heat. I was mentioning this before, and this is the one of the projects that I would like to introduce, which is basically a study of the formation in the last 30 to 50 years of a microclimate adaptation regime in urban planning and design, which goes back precisely to the, let's say, influence of climate science in urban planning. So I'm interested in how heat is known and also problematized as a microclimatic issue, as something that is not just related to global warming, but also to, let's say, local warming, dependent to a great extent on the materiality and the geometry of the urban fabric and of a specific urban places. So I'm also interested in how cities are, in that regard, how cities are redesigning urban surfaces and public spaces to kind of change the conditions for this local warming. And one of the overarching questions in this project is going to be precisely the question of the spatiality and the ontology of urban heat, and how that ontology and spatiality is constructed in such climatological problematizations, but also, of course, in concrete urban infrastructural projects. So we are going to do this by looking at two cities, which have played a crucial role in the formation in bringing forward these microclimatic adaptation regime, as I call it for the moment. One of these cities is Stuttgart, which is really fascinating. It was one of the first cities to actually incorporate a climatology department into the city administration structure already in the late 30s, 1930s. And since the 70s at the latest, has become a very important actor worldwide in pushing strategies and methods for microclimatic adaptation, precisely because it has developed the city of Stuttgart as a municipality, let's say, and particularly this department. They have developed many innovative, many methods and policy frameworks to address this. The most famous one, and some of you might have heard of this, is the Klima Atlas, which is basically a particular policy device that translates the notion of climatopes into the urban sphere and use that to set priorities and to establish parameters for urban development in different areas. And the Klima Atlas has become a main policy instrument that has been circulating worldwide to many other cities. And there are other methods and things developed in Stuttgart. It's a really fascinating kind of story, the one about this department. One of the big partners of Stuttgart and generally German micro or urban climatologists is Japan. There is a lot of kind of circulation of ideas and knowledge and between Germany and Japan. And so the other case, it will be the city of Fukuoka in Japan, which at the same time, it builds like an interesting contrast to Stuttgart. One aspect is that the main issue in, or the main sort of the leading idea in there is not so much abating heat stress, as it is the case in Stuttgart, but it's much more about achieving thermic comfort. So it's a more positive, let's say, approach to this issue. And what is also interesting is that the main institution that has been playing a shaping role in this is not in the city administration, but is actually a non-profit research foundation created in the 70s in collaboration with a local university. And that has been like the think tank of urban climatic thinking in that context. And they've been very, very successful in exerting a lot of influence on the urban policy and urban planning there. So that's kind of the setting for this project. It's a very much focus on this policy practices and knowledges. And it's gonna be, it's a 4-year project in the context of the SFB Refiguration of Spaces led by Martina Löw at the TU Berlin. And the interesting thing is that if things go well, this will be extended for yet another 4 years in which I will continue with this kind of topic. So this is a long-term sort of project, right? The second project I would like to introduce is an ERC consolidator grant called Urban Vibrations, How Physical Waves Come to Matter in Contemporary Urbanism. And on one level, this is a project that is built in a similar way, let's say, to the one I just presented, but perhaps it has like a more ambitious theoretical agenda, let's say. I will come back to that more ambitious theoretical agenda later on, but let's start with a more kind of conventional research design sort of part. So the ERC project focused on three airborne environmental phenomena, heat or sun radiation, sound waves, and EMF, electromagnetic fields. And more specifically, it looked at urban policy and urban design and urban controversies generally that relate to that to these three phenomena. So more concretely and very much in line of what I just said, so the mitigation and of the heat island effect is also part of this, the abatement of environmental noise, but also the implementation of 5G networks. So these are the three sort of fields that I'm going to be looking at. And there are good reasons for cities to be actually putting a lot of effort in urban transformations related to these three fields. So I have talked a little bit already about the urban heat island. I haven't mentioned so far how this is, of course, connected with all sorts of health concerns, heat stress, chronic respiratory conditions, for a wide range of people, particularly older people, homeless, people working on the streets, and also of obviously the effects of heat on urban natures. We know what is happening with many tree species, how they come to the border of extinction, at least in particular cities. So this is a serious sort of issue. And there is a lot of experimentation with different approaches to adaptation strategies, dealing with, all sorts of things, cool materials, as they are called, green and blue infrastructures, all sorts of different approaches to this. So, but I've talked a bit about this. The second thing that is also interesting is obviously these 5G networks, because obviously these 5G networks are now, the basis for the Internet of Things, and for that, for a lot of big business. But interestingly, 5G networks have encountered a lot of opposition also. As some cities, not many, but some of them, some cities have been passing bans, or they have issued very restrictive ordinances on the installation, basically responding to citizen concerns about the potential unknown, unclear health risks attached to the radio frequencies of 5G networks. And all these groups, even scientists as well, have been pointing to the lack of conclusive scientific evidence on the potential effects of these radio frequencies on human and non-human bodies. Brussels, for example, has been, so far, as at least 1 year ago, like 10 months ago, Brussels was so far the only European city that has put a halt to their work on a new 5G network, indicating precisely this uncertainty about health effects. And what is also interesting is the fact that this uncertainty, these feelings of insecurity among the population or certain groups of the population, are also very much connected with the presence of antennas in the urban environment. And one of the things that happens with the 5G networks is that, on the one hand, antennas are much smaller, so you don't have this kind of antenna trees that you had for 3G networks. You have much smaller antennas. But the fact that the radio frequencies are so high, it means that you need much more antennas in the city. Basically, one of these little boxes almost in every block, right? And so that has led to other controversies as well. For example, the city of San Francisco has a whole thing about the beauty of the urban landscape and the effect of the antennas have on preserving the heritage or whatever, and many other Californian cities, particularly in the Bay Area, have been using these sort of arguments to also ban or restrict the installation of antennas. And so actually there is a huge thing that just ended up in the California Supreme Court about this installation. So there are a lot of controversies, health related, but also, let's say, landscape design related controversies around these 5G networks. And the third one is noise, which has become and actually defined by the EU as the second largest environmental health hazard we are facing, with very harmful effects associated to heart disease, sleep disturbance, tinnitus, all sorts of things. 65% of the population in European cities are exposed or would be exposed to high levels. And to all that, the EU has responded already in 2002 with an environmental noise directive, which basically mandates all member states to implement action plans to reduce noise, right? And I will come back to, I will not say more about this because I will come back to this at the end of my talk. So these are the fields that I will be kind of looking at in this project, basically, well, ethnographically, right? And basically with two questions or with two sort of issues in mind. The first one, and perhaps the most important one, is the issue of bodily exposure. So how these different environmental phenomena are experienced, are known, and also made public by different actors. And the thing is that most research on bodily exposure in the field of environmental justice, for example, focuses on how, let's say, class, gender, and race, the classic variables, determine or have an effect on the levels of exposure to environmental risks or health hazards. In this project, we will approach the problem of exposure differently. And I think that the main focus will be on how exposure is, let's say, constructed or enacted through practices of knowing and practices of learning to be affected by this elusive environmental phenomenon. So we will study basically the relationship, or we will be paying attention to how the relationship between body and environment is constructed in specific practices of exposure, and how these practices entail tracing a line between what is the body, where is the limit between the body and the environment, and how that line, that limit is also open for contestation. So this entails many things, right? The first one is also in paying attention to knowledge practices concerning the intensity of this phenomena, right? Ranging from direct sensorial perception and over the use of sentinel devices, the use of sensors, in citizen science, modeling attempts, kind of trying to understand all the different ways in which the presence of this phenomena in the urban environment is known and attested. And there, one of the main interesting things, I guess, is how these elusive airborne phenomena are spatialized. I mean, in all these fields, we see a lot of experimentation with mapping techniques, all different strategies of how to map heat, how to map noise, how to map. So there is something about that which will be important. And the second part is, as I said before, is the question of how to know the harmful effects that these things might have on bodies of exposed individuals. And one of the things that we want to do here is to try to understand, collect stories and also collect devices related to how people learn to be affected by these things and how they attune themselves, yeah, their bodies and everyday practices to the presence of this phenomena. Because many of these things affect populations in very slow and invisible modes. The recognition that you are exposed is not obvious. I mean, and you have to learn to recognize, learn to be affected that you are exposed. And so that sort of practice is what is particularly interesting. And more generally, in relationship to these knowledge practices, there is a whole tension here between two epistemic and political values in all these controversies about this. One is kind of the side of one of these values is the burden of proof. I mean, the obligation to provide proof beyond reasonable doubt that there is exposure, that this exposure has negative effects and all that. But on the other hand, we have the kind of precautionary principle and this kind of idea of this obligation to act with caution, even without final evidence. And I think it's interesting to see how these two epistemic political values play out in tension in all these practices of knowing this wave-related or airborne environmental phenomena. And the second question in mind is the question of, let's say, urban coexistence. So how to imagine life together with these things in the air, let's say, right? So doing or exposure or learning to be affected leads to problematizations of how to live together, how things can be together in urban space. And that also is connected with calls for intervention and for redesign of urban environments. So basically, as in the project that I was mentioning before, the whole question of how cities, city administrations, based on a specific understandings of exposure, are implementing transformations of the urban environment is going to be one element of this. But the other element of this is also the role of critique and imagination, so to speak, and speculation. And the extent to which, and what we want to understand also is how these different affected groups, these different concerned groups are also in front of the lack of interventions in urban design, how they are kind of imagining cities and urban environment in different ways. Okay, I will skip this. So basically that's kind of the, let's say, the more conventional or the more, this is the research project, right? Three topics, two questions, and we'll see what happens. But perhaps the more ambitious part of this has to do with the fact that we are dealing here with waves. That's kind of the proposition here. So what all these projects have in common and all these phenomena and all these things have in common is that they involve attempts at learning to relate on the one hand, but also at governing how waves propagate in cities and how they affect urban life. And obviously this is not a technical issue. The most important thing is that these waves are very extremely elusive objects of government, of experience, of even research, right? And actually, they are not objects, they are not physical entities. That's the whole point of it. They are rather intensities that propagate through bodies and through things and through objects. And I think here's the more interesting kind of theoretical thing to try to get our heads around. Because we tend to imagine cities in, let's say, volumetric terms, a space kind of made of bodies and entities and things that are placed in different locations, that move across space, that enter in relationship to another. I mean, you could say even some of the key contributions of STS and other post-humanist perspectives to urban theory that have precisely emphasized the role of non-human entities, the role of non-human objects, the role of materials, the role of technological artifacts, non-human beings, plants, animals, all these things, how they play a role in the construction of cities, right? And by looking at waves, I think there is the possibility to go a little bit beyond this already very open ontology of entities and relationships. And I think the challenge here is by taking waves seriously, is taking into account at least two elements of waves. And one is what we could call the non-locality of waves. So waves are, yeah, they're all over the place. They're non-local phenomena. And their local manifestations are always partial and incomplete and indirect manifestations of what they are. So that's one of the elements. And the other element is that these waves invite us to think about, well, the transcorporeality, right? So they trespass or they surpass the boundaries between specific bodies, between specific entities, and they kind of operate at the interfaces between different entities. So I think this is interesting because my feeling is that a lot of the politics of the Anthropocene, so to speak, has to do precisely with the question of how we relate to elusive phenomena which are non-local, phenomena which are transcorporeal, and how we, and the politics of it is basically trying to fix, so to speak, try to connect these elusive phenomena to specific things, to specific objects, to specific bodies. And that moment of how these things come to matter, how they are materialized in specific entities, I think that's a very contested political moment, which I'm interested in tackling a little bit here. Okay, so that's basically, these are the two projects that I'm going to be working on, and I've been kind of also preparing during the last couple of years. So now the question to Axel is, how much time do I have? Because if I have more time, I could give an example from this. Let's see.
Yeah, I think a couple of minutes, maybe about 5 to 10 minutes.
Yeah, that's tricky. So let me just check what's. Okay, so no 15, right? No, okay.
It's negotiable. So just go ahead, Ignacio.
I will try to be super quick with this, but it will probably take me 10 minutes. So as I was saying at the beginning, so one of the things that was of inspiration for developing this project was studying a little bit the European guideline and urban policies for addressing environmental noise, which is, as I was saying before, is an issue that has been tackled by means of the Environmental Noise Directive from 2002. And it's really fascinating, and I will go super quickly through this, to see how this directive has been, let's say, for the moment, implemented in three different cities, Berlin, Barcelona, and London, because the ways in which it has been implemented, it cannot be more radically, diametrically different. In the case of Berlin, to be quick, somehow it was decided that the issue of environmental noise is an issue of car traffic. And that means, to make it short, that you cannot measure noise. When you make a map, you cannot measure, because you can, when you put a recorder, you cannot differentiate between the noise made by cars and the other sources of noise. So instead of measuring noise, noise made by cars is modeled in computers based on traffic flow information. And it's also interesting to see the fact that in Germany and in Berlin, noise is problematized as a health issue. And this is independent of whether you hear it or not. So it's not a matter of individual nuisance, it's a health problem. So they are very strict in that regard. And also the fact that the few things that they have been done practically about this, they attempt at kind of redesigning the street and basically making sure, and these are where the plans already back then, that there is more distance between cars and people. And bike lanes are good for that. And now, thanks to the Mobilitätsgesetz and other things, many of these plans are now also implemented. So that's kind of how they are put. In London is really, I love this example because there is a strategy from 2004 from the mayor of London, which says, so this is our strategy. And the noise plans that we do for the EU, we do it just for the EU. So that's not, this is, we do it for them, right? And it entails a very strong critique of noise mapping. So they say, first of all, we cannot wait until the maps are done, because it is actually evident, common sense, as the English will say, where the problems are. And second, they say, the problem with maps is that they represent average noise over a long period of time. And this whole maps, then what they do is that they distort reality. They distort the priorities, because they also only focus on average. So you improve the map, but you do not improve reality. So this is what they say in their strategy. And therefore, what they care about is about people's attitudes, people complaints, right? Perceived noise, which also goes together with a long tradition of not problematizing noise as a health issue in the UK. So the problem is here individual nuisance, not the harmful effects of noise. But they also say, we don't want to eliminate noise at all costs, because these are also cultural soundscapes, and this noise management is always a social balancing act. So that's the British implementation of it. And then you have Barcelona, which is also an extreme. So Barcelona is the only of the three here that it has a very broad definition of environmental noise. They include everything as that. And therefore they measure, right? So they measure noise. But measuring noise is very, very tricky. Because obviously the results can vary a lot depending on which day, where did you put the device? I mean, there's so many complications about that. So to solve that, what they have done basically is to work with a sample of streets. So they have classified all streets of the cities into 5 or 6 categories, and they sample streets and extrapolate the results to the other streets. And what is also interesting is, in Barcelona, they are not problematizing the problem of noise as a health problem, but it's not also an individual nuisance problem. It's actually, they problematize noise as a problem of a local conflict, right? Local conflicts, and the problem is basically based, in their opinion, on the uncivilized public behavior of some people, particularly tourists, but not only. So basically the whole plan in Barcelona is framed as an educational plan. I will not go into the details, but it would be fair to speak of a civilizatory project that they are attempting, which take, if we take into account a whole discourse in Barcelona about civismo, as they call it, being civic, right? Or and that's obviously quite different from the other case. So what I wanted to say here to conclude is, like, what do we do with this? And I think there are, and I will simplify in view of the time. I think there is a very classic solution to understand this variation. And we have practiced this in STS and in comparative policy studies for a long time, and which is basically to say that we know very well that when it comes to transnational risk governance or to transnational governance in general, guidelines and standards do not lead to standardization, because what matters are the local circumstances, how these guidelines and standards are implemented. And Sheila Yasanov, one is a very famous STS scholar, speaks in this context of epistemic subsidiarity. And what she means by that is that when it comes to transnational risk governance, epistemic subsidiarity is the principle that says that the, the details, let's say, of how to implement a particular standard need to be set at the lowest governance level, because this is also a way of respecting as well some local, historically grown, local public modes of reasoning, and so time-tested communal norms and forms of reasoning. So that's kind of the idea of epistemic subsidiarity. And we could say, yes, this is another case of epistemic subsidiarity. Standard gets implemented in different ways in three different cities. Now, I think this is of course right, yes, but it misses kind of an opportunity that these cases give us to reflect a little bit more about the two protagonists of this story. One is environmental noise, which is a very elusive category. And the second one is this environmental noise directive, which is also not clear what it does, right? So just to finish. So we are used to think about noise in terms of Mary Douglas. Mary Douglas is an anthropologist who said, dirt is matter out of place. And so we think of noise as sound out of place. That's a very common definition. Now, the interesting thing about environmental noise that it is not about a specific type of sound. So it doesn't refer to a specific type of sound, but rather to the overlapping of many different sound sources in place. Each of these sources are in place. They are not out of place. They are in place. They are fine. The problem is only the overlapping of these many sources, right? So, we move from an understanding of noise as some sort of ontologically determinate object, we know what it is, to a situation of ontological indetermination, in which environmental noise designates something that is totally indeterminate, undefined, unclear. It has an indeterminate ontology. It is everything, it can be anything. So basically that's the thing. So instead of Mary Douglas, we might go here with Michel Serres, which is a French philosopher for whom noise is not simply disorder, is not sound out of place. He theorizes noise as a form of indeterminacy that is generative, that is productive. So noise, he says, is the source of form. It's kind of the chaotic state that is necessary for things to organize or to self-organize. So taking this into account, what we have seen in these cities, which is like totally different problematizations and ways of ordering and approaching and knowing and governing noise, yes, we can look at it as epistemic subsidiarity. But actually, what is interesting is that this variation seems to be facilitated by this radical indeterminacy of environmental noise. So, and I could go on with this, but this is what I want to sort of suggest, that we that the study of these earned-board environmental phenomena, such as environmental noise and the others that I have just mentioned, can be taken as also opportunities to problematize and to open up some of the ways in which we also conceptualize these environmental phenomena, and to kind of open up what we also understand by the ontologies of things that matter. I will leave it at that, and I will thank you all for your attention.